Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Randy Moggins. Randy Moggins was an early indigo. He is eminently comfortable with technology, though not with the effects. As a kid, he built crystal radios, hacked antenna systems for shortwave and ham radio, played with tape recorders and electronic instruments, and interned at a local classical public radio station. His first computer was a Sinclair ZX81/1000, which served to learn BASIC. He went on to learn DBASE, Unix, and MS-DOS, as well as Pascal, MS-BASIC, HyperCard, and Visual Basic, before the advent of the web. He also worked as a software developer, consultant trainer, and system integrator, then moved onto the web, where in 2003, he began archiving MP3 audios of his radio shows. He is one of the first podcasters. Today, he designs and maintains all the websites for his shows, as well as for several clients. He continues to learn new software, including graphics, video, and audio production packages, while keeping up with ever-evolving web technologies. The websites are www.patreon.com/offplanetmedia and the original radio.offplanetmedia.net. I must say that Randy Moggins is a pioneer in the field, a true leader, and in my book, a living legend. And I'm really pleased and proud to have him on the show. It's been an interesting 2018, and we're going into 2019, and I'd like Randy's thoughts on what he sees in the short, intermediate, and the long term going forward. So without any further ado, Randy Moggins, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show, my friend.
You know, this is actually my maiden voyage into 2019. I haven't done anything so far this year, actually. We've kind of been on hiatus at Off Planet. So looking back, 2018 was, I would say, a year of extreme turbulence, where a lot of the veils got ripped down, and where posers, players, agents, and the general scumbags of this movement were actually getting exposed big time. It was a year, it was a difficult year, I think, for all of us. I think for anybody that's inside of this movement, whatever you want to call it, the communities of truth, this previous year, 2018, was a bumpy ride. And you can look at that mystically, spiritually, astrologically. But I think any of us that are working towards the goal of real disclosure, which is not what's been marketed out there, know that we've been pushing the rock up the mountain for a long time now. So that's kind of my retrospect. And looking forward, 2019 for me is the anteroom of 2020. And symbolically, 2020 signifies the resurgence of vision and the total rending of the veils, and the place where I think humanity finally can get a foothold to move forward in some pretty meaningful ways. So that's the nutshell from here right now.
One of the subjects I wanted you to discuss, Randy, was the so-called secret space program. We've been around long enough. We've seen how the alien abduction phenomena has developed research-wise over the years, fact-wise over the years, and then we began to see evidence of a deep black military aspect to it. The pioneering work of Dr. Carla Turner comes to mind, the great work of Jorge Martin in Puerto Rico, Bill Hamilton in Southern California, and a few others back in the day. And then along with the emergence of a number of legitimate my labs over the years who've come forth with bits and pieces of the larger puzzle. And then whammo, just a few years ago, this whole psychodrama, which we now know as the Secret Space Program, complete with a whole cast of characters, it's turned into a circus sideshow act. Did you want to comment on that, Randy?
The Secret Space Program. The running joke at Off Planet Radio TV is that the secret of the Secret Space Program is that it doesn't exist, but that's kind of tongue-in-cheek because it does. And I think from our perspective of people who not only are involved in this movement, but have lifetime involvement in mind control projects, paranormal activity, deep woo-woo spirituality. We know that there's something going on, but what's being presented to us is the disinformation, misinformation, COINTELPRO version of something that's very deep and very real. So what has been presented as SSP or secret space program on the internet, it kind of runs in a couple of different tracks. So this goes into a very long history, which I will I'll try to summarize this. Back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, as the internet was beginning to formulate, this would have been the era of Web 1.0. Most of the activity interactively on what was called the internet at that time was going on platforms hosted on Unix computers, and predominantly one platform known as Usenet groups. These were also known as list servers, different groups under the alt derivative, that's ALT, alt groups. And for those of us who were involved on forums online at that time, a great deal of information was passed about, distributed, and shared that was really very relevant, very deep, and very factually based revelations of the UFO juggernaut, and people who were experiencers, people who were inside military operations, intelligence operations, putting up extremely good work that kind of bolstered the argument of what's going on out there. There were a lot of people at that time who felt confident to disclose because of the anonymity of Usenet. The whole point of the earliest internet platforms was anonymity, total anonymity. There was no tracking of IP addresses. Everything at that point in time was basically run through Unix servers, and IP addresses were not denominated to the individual. We were dial-up era at that point. So technically, we were running modems from landlines, and there was no way to track back at that point of source to different information. And as a result of that, and a result of the anonymity of the groups themselves, a lot of information was deposited at that time that went into the information complex and into the collective consciousness that formed what then became, as the web itself took off, this vibrant UFO community that began disclosing a lot of information that was frankly very inconvenient for the dominant narrative that the government held at that time. And so if you flip forward through the 1990s into the Mosaic browser and the formulation of Web 2.0, which was really the beginning of the commercial web, we began to see the emergence of forums online, groups online that were dealing with the subject matter that had originally emerged out of the Usenet groups, the alt groups. And there was a great deal of information still being put out at that point. We got to the end of the 90s, we got into 2000, and then post 9/11, what we began to see was an operation that was launched inside of the government consortiums that control the internet infrastructure and large corporations that were forming, such as Google and Yahoo, who became the gatekeepers for information. And the, I will say, the bleaching of information, the ambiguation of information, and eventually just wholesale takedown of data that had been brought forward and exposed and talked about freely. As we moved into the era of high-speed internet access, where individuals began to have routers in the home that had designated IP addresses, the loss of anonymity began. Online services were able to pinpoint users. Identities began to emerge. And the actual disclosure movement, as organic as it was in, we'll say, the early 1990s, began to disappear off of the web. People who had valuable information sort of faded away because of the fact that they were being outed and exposed and harassed. And so This all plays into the narrative of the secret space program, because there's a grain of truth in any lie. And what has emerged as the secret space program is actually a hybrid of a number of things that are true. The government does run operations in what we call space. It is using highly advanced craft engineered over many decades. The technology that we see as commonplace now was, in fact, commonplace within intelligence, military operations, and specifically mind control operations and clandestine military operations in the 1960s and the 1970s. So almost all the emergent technology that we have now was actually anticipated many decades ago. That is what you would call the secret space program. And the secret space program itself masks a consortium of corporations that have been operating under various rubrics for decades to basically utilize assets inside intelligence communities to create financial, commercial, technological, and human trafficking cabals that have been used, again, against the people themselves for various operations. Does this entail some sort of deep space operation? I don't rule that out. But for our purposes, what we can assume at this point is that this is not even a U.S. government program. This is actually multinational, and it actually comes under the umbrella of what we would call the ruling elite, the cabal, whatever.
Yes, I would agree with that, Randy, because I was on those forums. And back in the old days, we simply had email groups where me and close friends, Eve Lorgan, a number of other people, would share dreams, share experiences. And then when the forums came along and the bulletin boards, again, we had the benefit of the anonymity, which you referenced, Randy. We'd come up with these cutesy usernames and we'd share information. And some of us had friends on those forums. We knew who each other were, so we felt comfortable sharing certain types of information. And the knowledge base grew because we are not totally unique. If one of us had an experience and we retained enough memory about a particular experience, chances are someone out there had gone through the same or a similar experience, because exactly. We're not that special. We're not that unique, completely at variance with the kind of egomaniacal mindset so many of these faux whistleblowers have today. We just knew that we had to get certain information out because we were trying to provide validation and confirmation for others. And it was very much an us versus them mentality. Because we were going through this stuff, it was an outrage. Our personal dignity, our sovereignty was being radically impacted. And so that was our motivation for banding together and anonymously. A quick point about the beginnings of the so-called secret space program, or whatever anyone wants to call it. The way I look at it, Randy, was with the recovery and retrieval of the alien technology that had come into possession first of the military and then to the aerospace corporations to back engineer and develop, what have you. To me, that was at least the basis for all this. At some level, someone in authority would want to create an off-world capability, or at least a capability that would allow them at some level to control the destiny of the Earth using this technology. So you're absolutely right when you say that back in the 60s and 70s, this technology was already operational. It was not in the experimental phase. They were already utilizing it in operations. And I've known of people kidnapped and utilized in my lab ops back in the 60s, at least.
Yeah. And again, that exists in our memories. I've mentioned this a couple of times in various shows, my memory of technology. Something as at this time unremarkable as plasma screen and LCD displays, and how I remember being in a room being tested, and how images were being basically streamed to us in a room using a device that made no sense. in the late 1960s. The devices themselves were high speed, very high resolution graphics projected onto a surface, but not by conventional means, using what at that time would have been Super 8 millimeter film slides or overhead projectors, but seamless, very high speed graphics. And I've talked to a number of people who have those same memories. And see, that was the value of that early ability for us to be able to huddle together with anonymity. Not only the safety, but being able to discuss with other people events that were so anomalous that I think you begin to even doubt whether they were true or not. My experience of doing what I've done since 2009, which has been off planet radio, has been the amount of confirmation that I've gotten about my own experiences, largely by talking to people who come from similar backgrounds. That affirmation is hugely important to even just our sanity, our ability to function, because I think for most of us, we're dealing with a huge amount of trauma, a huge amount of cognitive dissonance. The programming that went into being inducted into clandestine programs that used children, and just overall sense of miasma that we had, that there was something going on that we knew about, but we had no confirmation, and how important it was to be able to get that validation in a setting that was both safe and affirming.
And it allowed us to network with others of a like mind, people that we would otherwise never have the opportunity to meet and talk to. And I know that interacting with these others anonymously really helped me. And it prompted me to write a series of articles back then, just sharing what I gleaned from close colleagues and what memories fragmented otherwise that I managed to retain. And so I put out a series of papers, and then that resonated with others, and then they contacted me, and then the knowledge base grew. And then you were doing your own thing, others were doing similar things. We all had not met yet through what we call the World Wide Web. And one thing that I really need to stress to the listeners is, once again, this us versus them mentality. There was a real sense of outrage that we had back then. It wasn't this gee whiz, look at me, you know, I'm a super soldier mentality. A lot of us were going through a lot of harassment, black helicopters. I had friends staying at my place, and they told me they never heard so much helicopter activity anywhere in one place. It's around my house and around my neighborhood. And by that time, Randy, I'd kind of tuned it out, you know what I mean, for my own sanity. But when people came over and stayed, it's like it stuck out like a sore thumb. How could you live like this? You know, your windows are rattling, right? And so,
Yeah.
you
Or the
know.
electronic interference that goes on, and the gaslighting and the psychological warfare that occurs. It just after a while, you almost acclimate yourself to it. The things that go wrong that conceivably just mathematically shouldn't happen, and how our personal lives are basically subject to a huge amount of interference that, by just pure effort alone, my life should have been vastly different than it was. And the fact of the matter is that when I would move 2 steps forward, somebody would come along and kick me down again. And it was done in ways that made you even doubt your own sanity about it. Those are all psychological warfare games that get played against people who are targeted, people who have been in programs, people who have had contact with this. Sometimes I don't even know what to call it. I mean, when you start to factor in the paranormal, the UFO experiences, the unclassified programs, your world starts to look like the Twilight Zone on acid pretty quickly. And yet somehow or another, we have to function as normal human beings, having lives and families and careers and all that. And the way we do it is we simply stumble forward and just by sheer dint of the fact that we are who we are, and we are extraordinary. Anybody who has been inside any of these programs, projects, been part of the targeting and harassment are extraordinary by definition because of the fact that they have already garnered this much attention, probably from birth. So, I mean, I don't back away from that. I have high regard for the legitimate people out there who have been part of these programs as being truly extraordinary human beings who have just managed to survive when I think both you and I know that thousands of people were literally killed by our own government inside these programs.
I would agree, Randy. Some of the dear friends I have that I cherish, they are extraordinary by any standards, and they've managed to stay heart-centered. They've managed to stay loving and upbeat. And the fact that I'd gotten to know these people will always be a good thing. Another thing that we found over time, Randy, and I'd like your input over this, was the training and the apparent operations that some of these MyLabs and some of these people in these projects were being put through. And again, it goes back to childhood. I clearly remember times when I was a child being around medical people or having missing time in medical places also. Yeah. And then later, there were times when I'd be in these training ops and the times when I'd be in a military scenario and would see a bunch of children there. They would be being put through their paces. They would be getting exercise and running and being put through drills. And I've seen this many, many times. So the process is ongoing.
The training was, I would say, paramilitary in the terms that it required a certain amount of physical rigor, agility, certain core skills, even down to martial arts and use of weapons and things like that. The very purpose behind these was to develop innate skills that were part of our profiles. And when I say profiles, I'm comfortable at this point saying that the evidence proves, based on the interviews, the background conversations I've had, my own experiences, that we were profiled certainly from birth and possibly pre-life. And coming in, they understood who we were and what our skills and our talents were. In addition to that, there are psychic skills, certain emotional temperaments, profiles that lend themselves to the kind of operations they wanted. They were not all military and they were not all what I call hard assets. So there were numerous soft assets used as well in terms of people who were psychically gifted and people who had emotional temperaments that were useful to a program, including empaths and people like that. So they weaponized every aspect of who the subjects are, and they had no compunction at all of collateral damage in the field in terms of training, experiments, and exercises. And it should be borne in mind that I think we all have memories of people who have disappeared, been disappeared, or people who suffered grievous mortal injury as a result of these programs. People who have come out of numerous programs, notably Montauk, note the casualties there were in the thousands as a result of what they were doing with the chair at Montauk. I have memories of a base in Maryland where there was on the ground and underground training taking place where at least one subject was shot on site because he blew cover. And that was done as an example. This was probably about a 9 or 10 year old child. They have no problem with this. They're psychopaths. And I, you know, whenever you listen to legitimate whistleblowers, you will hear in their voices the sorrow and the grief that they carry. Those are scars that are carried. And it's one of the ways you can distinguish between the sideshow that has been staged on the internet, and that's using a soft term in itself, and legitimate whistleblowers and legitimate survivors of intense programs. There's a sorrow, there's a grief there, there's a sense of loss, there's a sense of damage as a result of what they experienced and what they saw. And so the whole showbiz thing that's now been fronted by a number of different factions on the internet showcases people that lack the emotional depth and the integrity that sits behind genuine survivors of these undisclosed programs. One of our dear colleagues at Off Planet Radio, Elisa E., who's a survivor of Monarch and MKUltra programming, has stated that everybody who has been through these projects is in some way or another on either a fast-track death or a slow kill. And the slow kill seems to be the preferred method. They let you live and they let you simply spiral down until the point where you're unviable anymore. Or there is a suicide program that gets initiated and eventually that takes place in any number of ways. The bottom line is that survivors of these programs are the inconvenient truth that lives amidst us, and it needs to be constantly disclaimed and eventually destroyed so that the evidence is gone. And obviously, you know, using psychological warfare, gaslighting, all of that is an effective way to silence the survivors, the witnesses who don't have hard evidence. I mean, nobody got to carry souvenirs out of a project that I know of. And for the most part, even your most precious possession, the content of your own mind, your memories, were also taken away. Because one of the things that they do whenever you are used in a project is that you are then, quote, deprogrammed, meaning you are wiped and reset for the next round. So the people who have memories, which no mind control is perfect, throughout all of the efforts made by the military and the pharmaceutical industry over the last 100 years, headed by the Rockefeller Foundation, they have not found a way to completely 100% ensure that they can expunge all memory. And the more traumatic memories do tend to reside in the body itself. Trauma is stored in the body, memory is stored in the body, and that's the most difficult part, is that they focus mind control on the mind, whereas in fact, on a cellular level, we retain a great deal of our own memories. So again, you know, there is no perfect record of any of this. The anecdotal evidence that's presented by survivors is extremely important, but it's also extremely important as to who's talking, which kind of takes us into, you know, I think where we're going to go today with some of the players out there, the posers who have been hired, sponsored, promoted to present a sanitized version or a version of these programs and projects, which becomes laughable and makes a mockery out of what actually occurred.
Yes, it reduces the whole subject to the theater of the absurd, or reduces it to a circus sideshow act,
yeah,
a clown show. And I refer to some of these people as the space cowboys, because it doesn't sound like they've really gone through any kind of trauma, some of them. And also the profiling that you spoke about earlier, Randy, where these people fit a particular psychological profile, a person that suffers from grandiosity, some degree of narcissism. They like to be in the limelight.
Yep.
And their motives are all selfish. It's got nothing to do with reaching out and wanting to help others. You're right. They've managed to turn it into a brand. Remember that time on Twitter not too long ago where this new guy that just surf popped up out of the woodwork, he sent this tweet out. Apparently, he claimed an underground base where he was showing all this woo-woo technology, and he was saying, you know, he felt so proud to be part of this black project. And I'm thinking, they must not take operational security very seriously at this point if they're going to let him send out a tweet, which was retweeted, folks, 70,000 times.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
Put that right, okay? And you compare this to what we went through back in the day. And
The thing about the posers also is their narrative, Randy, is radically pushed by the system. The search algorithms in YouTube and on the internet in general will drive people, searchers looking for this kind of information in their direction, right? And then their views are artificially bumped up, and it just created this morass, this miasma of confusion.
Yeah, the incident to which you refer there, and I'm more than happy to say this, that was Jordan Sather, who comes out of the Corey Good Group. He's actually what another operative, can I say that? I will, has termed Corey's kids. This is a group of young people who coalesced around Corey Good back in 2017, specifically at Contact in the Desert in Joshua Tree, California. And Jordan Sather has become a media figure as a result of his association with David Wilcock and Corey Good. He was sort of hand-selected. He is he's sort of the model of somebody you would want to see in front of you. He's a reasonably good-looking guy. He's relatively well-spoken. And he has this penchant for putting up whiteboards and explaining point-by-point facts, so-called, on various alternative conspiracy-type information. That particular tweet was so hilarious because anybody that knows anything about an underground base is going to understand, first off, your freaking Android phone isn't going to work there. Nothing works under there except what they want to work. And you wouldn't really be allowed to have a device like that inside of any secure location. So, you see, that's all created as grist for the mill. What I'll say, the gullible two-thirds of people who imbibe this information enjoy that kind of, it's voyeuristic, but it's an entertainment aspect to it, which is what's disturbing about it. The surface level of all this is that nothing is as it appears, and they continue to promote this kind of superficiality as a way, A, to take down legitimate whistleblowers, many of whom who are not media savvy, and also to discredit actual information. And secondly, just to create this theatrical atmosphere around something that, quite frankly, however interesting it is not entertainment. That's what's happened, I will say, since 2003 forward, but it certainly sped up sometime around 2010. I started to notice how legitimate information was declining and the level of popcorn munching was greatly increasing. And it was coming from some very specific vectors, one of which is David Wilcock. And it goes into who David Wilcock is and his background, some of which we know, some of which we've gotten a little bit insight into. But David Wilcock was largely launched out of another cult. And it was a group who were formulated by the late Carla Rucker, who was a channeler of the raw material, also called the Law of One. And David Wilcock was a part of that group. He was promoted by that group. There were several rounds of branding with David before they found what clicked. Initially, the first round was a book written by one of the adherents to Law of One named Wynn Free. David Wilcock is the reincarnation of Edgar Cayce. And that book was released, 2011 maybe? This is a loose timeline because I don't have any of this in my notes. But I want to say 2010, 2011, that sort of hit high tide. But it might have been earlier than that. So the first launch was David Wilcock as the reincarnation of Edgar Cayce. Wilcock went to Virginia Beach to ARE, which is the Edgar Cayce Foundation. They have a campus there. And attempted to get the imprimatur of the Cayce family on this, and he was rejected. He was audited by the committee who control ARE, and he just didn't pass muster. So basically, we went back to how are we going to market David? And David was working with Richard C. Hoagland, who was the Face on Mars guy, who was a he was a science editor for CBS News back in the Walter Cronkite era. He was deeply aligned with NASA. And Hoagland was running a website where David Wilcock was a frequent contributor. As a result of that, and this is how you get to something that I will call the promoted asset. In other words, somebody who surfaces, who is malleable material and able to be used. As a result of his connections with Richard C. Hoagland, who was a friend of Art Bell, he then was promoted on Coast to Coast AM. Through the Art Bell era, not so much, but more so into the George Noory era after Art Bell sold Coast to Coast AM. By the way, Art Bell deeply regretted doing that. I know because I was on a conversation with him and a friend of mine, and Art deeply regretted doing that. But that is where you get the rise of David Wilcock, who then proceeds to integrate the raw material Law of One into his worldview, which is conspiratorial and even combative to what he calls the cabal, the New World Order, the Illuminati. And David really builds a front here, being the anti-establishment hero slash New Age guru. He's written books that are New York Times bestsellers, heavily researched pieces of material. He has largely been a focal point for this juncture between the UFO community, the new consciousness movement, and the conspiracy movement. And so when we talk about Corey Good, we have to talk about David Wilcock, because David Wilcock created Corey Good as we know him now.
That's a great synopsis, Randy. I was not aware of David's background, but I was always trusting my own instinct and gut level intuition about him, and something about him turned me off. So I never developed an interest in him one way or the other. And then poof, finds out years later that he's pushing Corey Good. One thing about David Wilcock, which never made sense to me, was he's supposed to be the reincarnation of Edgar Cayce. Edgar talked about pole shifts. David Wilcox didn't believe in pole shifts. So there was a contradiction. I guess, like you said, he didn't pass muster with the ARE people. One thing about Corey Good was he was reaching out to me, Randy, I mean, pretty severely. And I was dragged kicking and screaming into the Project Avalon MyLab forum by friends. I didn't want to go. And then, long story, it took me a long time to even unsubscribe from that. That's a whole other story. But I was dragged in there and just saw this miasma of just acrimony, infighting, all this other stuff. Corey Good was at the heart of it. And that's when I first heard about him. Well, no, actually, I first heard about him when he was reaching out to me, and I basically blew him off, right? And then when I was dragged, kicking and screaming into Project Avalon, there he was. And so since I'm there, I read some of his stuff. Didn't resonate at all. Would you like to talk a bit about Corey Good? Because he has been pushed out to the forefront by David, and now he's like the focal point of all this.
Yeah, the thing about Corey Good is that he, again, is one of those opportunities for promotion because he was malleable material. He actually showed up on the Project Avalon forum in 2013. And I've been on Avalon since 2009. And like you said, getting off of there, forget about it. I've never been able to figure a way out of Project Avalon.
Abandon hope, all ye who enter.
Exactly. No, it's a giant sucking sound, as Ross Perot once called it. You will be assimilated. So he shows up in 2013, and he's largely a researcher. And he's researching a lot of different things. He's posting very actively. In 2014, he's interviewed by Christine Anderson, who is the ex-wife and was also a moderator on Project Avalon. Christine is a friend of mine. I have contact with her. I interviewed Christine over Corey Good back in 2017 when I finally went full bore on Corey. So he did this 2014 interview with Christine Anderson. It was actually just a conversation. Christine was in Texas, trying to remember what city in Texas now, whether it was Houston, but it was done with a tiny voice recorder, which was then used as the formulation for the first Corey Good interview. In that interview, he's very scattered. He's in a lot of pain. He's unemployed. He's on disability as a result of an injury, which he claims was the result of him having to move a very large server rack while in the employ of a contractor. Corey's own LinkedIn site lists skills that link him to largely being an IT person connected to what you would call a systems administrator, which makes no sense as to why he would have been moving racks. Sysadmins generally don't do grunt work, but okay. His skills, by the way, belie the fact that he made claims in 2016, 2017 that he, quote, gave up his over $100,000 a year plus employment to become a whistleblower. Skills that he lists on LinkedIn that are certifiable would place his skill value as at between optimally $50,000 to $70,000 a year based on the skills he lists. So he counts on gullibility, and he counts on the fact that people don't have a good grasp of, for instance, the IT industry and what he actually was doing, even in terms of his own listed skills. In the background, after 2014, he's conferring with David Wilcock, who is under contract to Gaia TV at that point to headhunt talent. That was literally David Wilcock's description. The reason I know that is I was in Boulder, Colorado in 2013 at a conference where I encountered several people who were connected to Gaia. One of them connected to one of Gaia's leading hosts told me that David Wilcock was contracted by Gaia TV to produce shows. He was very unhappy about it. This was somebody who had sold property to Gaia and had distinctly said, please do us a favor, keep David Wilcock away from us. These were people who were in this scene and understood what was going on with David. And so but in 2013, he signed a contract. Now, I was in Boulder in October of 2013, and by 2014, Corey Good is full-blown. In 2015, Good is in negotiations with Wilcock and Gaia TV to begin development of what ultimately would become Cosmic Disclosure. And in July of 2015, season one, episode one of Cosmic Disclosure with David Wilcock and Corey Good airs. That series ran with Corey Good and David Wilcock up until, I think, the end of last year, at which time something happened, and we'll talk about that. So in 2017, as a result of Corey being on Gaia TV, and I will say industry pressures by Gaia themselves, Corey Good headlines Contact in the Desert at Joshua Tree, California, as well as he's a major speaker at the LA Health Expo, which is a major event centered around the New Age alternative holistic movement. And he is also one of the headliners at the Las Vegas MUFON Secret Space Program Conference in 2017, where there's a panel that's hosted by Richard Dolan and includes Andy Bishago and several others. And Corey's sort of taken to the woodshed at this point by Dolan. So as a result of the Contact in the Desert foray, Good in the background is beginning to formulate with another actor named Richard Rogers, or Richard Rogers Ramsar, known as Roger Ramsar, this Full Disclosure Now, and a production company which is designed to basically do outside projects, including filmmaking and, quote, graphic novels, comic books, T-shirts, all the swag stuff. So that was a business model that Corey was already beginning to run, some of it with David Wilcock and some of it with his partner, Roger Ramser. So that's the emergence of Corey Good. What I did when 2017, I did two interviews, one with Christine Anderson, where Christine discussed her first person face-to-face meeting with Corey Good and what happened as a result of that first quote interview. And then the events that transpired when there was a second interview and what happened on the Avalon Forum, which literally went into psychic panic mode as a result of what Corey Good was doing, including triggering Bill Ryan himself. So, I mean, Corey's been, if I can use the term, he's been a living shitstorm almost everywhere he's gone. And at a second interview in 2017 with Shane Bales, who's also known as the Ruiner. Shane is legitimately part of an Illuminati family. He has been in projects. Shane has been very transparent about the fact that he was sent into the alternative media to watch it, to observe it. And he had interactions with Corey Good going back to 2014, around the time that he published his revelations about the hierarchy on a website called ruiner777.blogspot.com. So Shane was on the record. Corey opposed Shane. Shane exposed the Blue Avians as basically being a confabulation by Corey Good to gain the attention of David Wilcock, which in fact, by Corey's own admission, he has said that the Blue Avians are very similar, quote, to the law of one, the raw material. And many people have said that Corey, basically, in order to gain the attention of Wilcock and to get onto Gaia TV, took the Blue Avian material that he had been roughly trying to pull together on other forums outside of Avalon into a cohesive whole so that he could weld it onto his narrative, the Secret Space Program. So that's convoluted, that's wordy, but that's a thumbnail view of the emergence of Corey Good.
Interesting how he dovetails his Blue Avian spiel with Wilcock's Law of One, Carla Rueckert. I remember all that. It's almost like he scouted out what Wilcock was into and said, okay, I'm going to make something, put it together that's going to be agreeable to Wilcock, and then, you know, presto, then you have this dream team of him and Wilcock working together.
You also brought up MUFON, Randy, and I always thought it was curious why MUFON, of all organizations, would have people like Corey Good and Basiaggio on a panel. I mean, it was so at variance with what they have represented in the past, because many of us regarded MUFON as a gatekeeping organization. True, they did have within their ranks some outstanding investigators, Leonard Stringfield, Bill Hamilton, but especially at the local level, you had some real, real stick-in-the-mud, lights-in-the-sky, aliens-don't-exist types. So I just thought it was curious that of all organizations, MUFON, which had raked over the coals many legitimate whistleblowers in the past, would suddenly have a panel with people like that on it.
Yeah, what happened there with the MUFON panel was you can't script this stuff. And understand that people who book these events a lot of times don't understand the dynamic that's going on as well. The presence of Richard Dolan represents an interesting kind of wrinkle in things, because I think Richard Dolan himself represents a sort of gatekeeper mentality. Whether he's actually a gatekeeper, I've met Rich. I interviewed him in Boulder. I spent a couple of days observing Richard Dolan, which was interesting. And Richard Dolan is one of the camps here that's in play. If we can divide the two camps right now, on the one hand, we have the experiencer, anecdotal evidence slash whistleblower, no hard evidence, no actual science. That would be sort of the Corey Good side of the equation. Then on the other side of the equation, we have what's called, I call the hard researchers. These would be people like Dolan himself, Joseph Farrell. You would say that the hard researchers are the people who are bringing forward valuable information about technology, about government documents, which Richard Dolan is very much into and which I think is a major stumbling block as well. So we have two camps around the secret space program. Now, let me go back for a minute, because in 2012, I can't remember, we had the first secret space program conference, which was held in the Netherlands, and that was sponsored by a group who actually did the Boulder conference that I attended. I actually know these promoters. There was a second secret space program held in California in 2015, hosted by Henrik Palmgren of Red Ice Radio. And then in 2016, again, the timelines are loose because I don't have this in front of me, but I want to say maybe it was 2015. There was a second conference in Bastrop, Texas, which is a podunk outside of Austin. That was hosted by the dark journalist guy. And Corey Good was very prominently not invited to that. That was the, quote, hard researcher group that put on that secret space conference. So we've had three conferences under the title the Secret Space Program. And in that time, that narrative of the secret space program has sort of evolved out of the work of Richard Dolan, Catherine Austin Fitz, who was an undersecretary of HUD in the George H.W. Bush era back in the 90s, who documented missing trillions of dollars, and the research and writing of Joseph P. Farrell. And then there's some other people also inside of that conference as well, who are considered hard researchers, documentarians, and evidence gatherers. So you have two factions basically warring for the secret space program. And what happened with Corey, whatever was intended to happen with Corey, because Corey is a project himself. He was sponsored heavily, and he was brought in by David Wolcott. But I would argue that on the other hand, some of the assets used on the other side are similar as well. I've challenged the narrative and I've challenged the emergence of dark journalists. I've done that openly. And in fact, I've done it to dark journalists himself, just as I did Corey Good. That there seems to be people who are sponsored assets who are brought in to promote a particular aspect of a subject. And they create two sides of it. And there's migration between the two sides, but there's also a fair amount of friction. This creates an atmosphere where nobody really knows what this thing is, whether it's UFOs, whether it's black projects, or whether it's a secret space program. But demonstrably on both sides, I can point to assets that I know were inserted into the dialogue for the purpose of taking it in a certain direction. So I don't say this to dishonor any of these people personally, because for the most part, I don't know them. And in some cases, I think these actors, and I will call them that, are not aware of their roles at the time. I suspect they become more aware of that as time goes on. I think Corey's pretty aware that he's being used. I also think he's being used willingly because of the fact that there was a monetary aspect to Corey that really wanted to do this. He saw the brass knuckle, the brass ring, and he took it. And that's true with a number of other operators in this field. Some of these are researchers who have gone in a certain direction, some of whom I do think are honest, and some of whom I think use a fair amount of biased logic in order to arrive at a narrative that they then can unfold to write books or produce videos. So this is by no means simple in terms of defining what the secret space program is, how it's represented, and who the players are who are competing for the rights to own this monolith called the Secret Space Program.
Well, we've reached the end of a fascinating first segment with our guest, Randy Moggins of Off Planet Radio.
Randy Moggins and Emily Moyer have recently launched a new website, which is www.patreon.com/offplanetmedia. That's www.patreon.com/offplanetmedia.
If you like what we do here at the Cosmic Switchboard Show, please go to our website, thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.